Just going to have a quick check of the Spotify charts while we're here.
Oh, yeah.
Last time I checked, didn't we hit like 13 out of all science podcasts?
No, we didn't hit 13. What are you talking about? Oh my god, we're at
13. Are we at 13?
Oh, we're at 13? Oh, you should have got a screenshot of when we all heard that. That'd have been so... Oh, but if...
We have a recording,
you
ding dong.
You're recording it.
I'm such an idiot.
You're recording.
I should have recorded that moment.
Whoa.
I wish we had microphones for this.
Oh my god.
Hello and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Woo. Today we're going to hit you with a big main science. All right.
We're going to 1-2 you with a science topic and a question. And then when you least expect it, the miscellaneous.
As Tom just said, today we're coming at you with a big main science topic. Then we're going to answer a science question. Then we're going to take a little walk around, a little pleasant time around a miscellaneous topic. I'm Ella, and I'm covering today's main science topic, which is self-experimentation.
Oh! I'm just so interested, because I don't know what this could cover, but the common feature is something.
Yeah.
The common feature is something.
Sure is something.
Great. Yeah, excellent.
I'm so excited to hear more about this. It's going to be so much fun. My name's Caroline, and this episode's question is going to be, when was the oldest human limb amputation carried out?
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I think I've heard...
You might have heard a little bit about this recently.
I think I might have heard about this, but I'm very curious to dive deeper into this question. Yeah. I could be wrong, so I'm very curious. My name's Tom, and today's miscellaneous topic is the beauty behind one of the most maligned pieces of software ever, Microsoft PowerPoint.
Okay, I'm excited. I use PowerPoint a lot, actually. I use it to make scientific figures. So, mm-hmm.
Oh, mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm excited then to get into that.
So today's main topic is self-experimentation. By that, I don't mean experimenting with your sexuality. I mean experiments. Oh.
That is sort of where my brain went for a second there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean experiments scientists have done on themselves. I'm basically going to go through a list of self-experimentation that I find really interesting.
We're going to go through a list of fucked up things, aren't we, basically?
Basically. Some of them less than others, but yeah. And I think you probably will have heard of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. And the majority of cases we're going to be talking about today occurred in the 1900s, because this was like a really big period of exponential scientific and medical discovery, right? Mm-hmm, and part of that speed, I think, can be contributed to a lack of rules on like animal testing and human testing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I will say, at the same time, as much as it feels extremely morally dubious to test on yourself, there is something about it that is like, hey, at least
I'm doing this on myself rather than some like poor child I pulled off the street or something.
Right,
like that,
exactly.
You know?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. You know, we've talked about things like the Tuskegee syphilis study.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
When I was talking about conspiracy theories, for example, and that's like, you know, unethical human experimentation, but on a, you know, it's much more ethically acceptable when the human experimentation is on yourself. It's not always smart. But it is it is always consented to, right? And that is the main point.
I think that's what I was trying to get at with why I said, like, it feels so something. Is there is, like, this quandary within myself where I'm like, it is? It's good? It's not smart? I feel of many ways about it, so I am very excited to hear these examples and maybe, like, figure out what it is that I'm feeling.
And like I said, we're mainly going to be talking about the 1900s, but for the first example, let's go back to the 1500s.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
The Venetian physician, Santorio Santorio, who was born in 1531. Basically, what he did is he spent the best part of 30 years eating, sleeping, and working on a large scale. A chair that had on one side was a
no.
One side
it.
Was a chair, on the other side was a counterbalance. And he constructed it so he could measure fluctuations in his body weight compared to what went into his body versus what went out.
Oh.
What?
Oh, so he lived on a scale, like on a measuring scale. Can I? Okay. Yeah. What?
That's such a bizarre way of going about it, you know? But I get
Wait,
it.
Wait, so he was measuring what he was eating was his self-experimentation.
Kind of. And drinking and perspiring. He believed that health was an ideal balance between ingestion and excretion. He thought his idea was it was a perfect separation. And he published his findings in 1614 in the book Distatitia Medicina. I'm so
Nailed
sorry,
it.
Italian people. it means basically static medicine. And many of his findings basically boiled down to the idea that the sum of things excreted is less than the sum of what is put in.
I mean, yeah.
Which is not what he hypothesized. I will say, reading excerpts from this book, I'm so glad I didn't have to read it myself to understand what he did. because let me read a short excerpt.
Oh
boy.
This is a proper medical textbook.
Took a
okay?
big poop today. Thursday.
Take notice. In a morning, following a plentiful supper of the greatest quantity that perspires in the space of 12 hours, suppose it be 50 ounces. Some other morning observe the same. After eating not supper, and provided there was no excess in the former day's dinner, which supposed to be 21 ounces, then choose such a settled quantity of food and keep such a use of non-naturals as will bring the quantity perspired to a mean between 50 and 20 ounces.
Oh my, what?
That is... What? Which I'm just amounts to like I had two slices of toast today.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Like when you do the math, when you like when you reduce the synonyms in
when
that
you take
sentence,
out
it reduces
all of the
down.
Fluff of that sentence. What you actually get is I ate a lot of food today.
It's like he's basically saying exactly the measurement, the weight of the food that he ate in that day.
But he's making it a story.
Yeah.
And he says at the end, and by this means may a person be brought to such perfect standard of health as will last to 100 years.
Did he think he had the perfect standard of health then?
I've no idea. No idea.
Can I? It's also really, I don't know if it's settling or unsettling. I think it's nice to know that this sort of concept of diet culture has been around since that long ago. The idea that it's like, I figured it out. I just have to have two slices of toast and I'll live to 100. Yeah.
I will say, I think what I say about him next will change your opinion on him now. So,
okay.
So he attributed the difference in weight to a concept called insensible perspiration, which is still a term used today. And it means the loss of water through skin, which does not occur as perceivable sweat. Santorio wouldn't have known it at the time, but that actually means we have a near constant rate of pure water loss from our epithelial cells in our skin that isn't sweat.
Oh, wow. Oh, so he was spot on.
Yeah, he had a very clear concept, and the amount of water lost through insensible perspiration is about 400 ml a day, and it's the main source of heat loss in the body.
Oh.
Wow.
The fact that not everything we consume comes out as excrement probably seems very obvious to us now.
Right, yeah.
But
right.
This is one of the earliest and most extensive work on basically what now we understand is basal metabolism. Before his work, most of our understanding of metabolism came from theoretical observations. So Santorio introduced the concept of quantitative measurements into physiological research. Which is incredibly powerful. He was the first person to do anything like this, like taking strict measurements every day.
I do see that. The reason it was hard for my mind to get there is because I just saw a guy sitting in a chair with like a rope pulling mechanism that you were describing, and then like taking poops and stuff. But no, that is an amazing point. I would not have imagined people would be coming to those kinds of conclusions so early on, like the 1500s.
Yeah.
That's wild. That's really wild.
Yeah, I think it's...
And by yourself is amazing. Like, I'm sure, obviously, there's a body of scientific research, but to take this upon yourself I at first felt like I was like, this can't be real science.
I think he took measurements from, like, if records are correct, like thousands of people over his lifetime, but he mostly took measurements from himself because he could do, you know, he could afford to live in this chair. A 2018 paper from the Max Planck Institute actually describes creating a replica of Centaurio's chair.
Oh.
No way.
They just wanted to gain a general understanding of his methods and see if they could make like a tool which worked today in the same way.
Oh, that's cool.
They don't actually seem to achieve either of those things because it's so hard to like pass out how he did it in his writings because it's just not very clear. But one of the interesting things I learned from that paper was that because of the way the counterbalance system works in the chair, the counterbalance never changes weight. So the way he determined the change of weight was by measuring the change in distance from the floor to the chair.
Oh my god! I mean, yeah, that makes complete sense.
I guess, yeah, but at the same time, it's like, god damn it, the chair's so high. It's like, it's working, but also now I need a stepladder.
That took place in the 1500s, and we're jumping ahead 400 years to the 1900s, where most of the things we're looking at will take place. So in 1938, Nathaniel Kleitman and his research assistant spent 32 days in Mammoth Cave in 12 degrees Celsius with no natural light. They wanted to be deprived of environmental clues. Do you guys have any ideas why?
Yeah. Sorry, I love these kinds of experiments. The obviously with the bee time perception stuff, all of this, the circadian rhythm shit, I love dearly.
That is it. Oh. Okay. Tom didn't even realize he was answering a question, but he did. they were trying to determine if the body had a natural biological clock. This is one of the earliest works on this.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, a 28-hour cycle was imposed on them. They did 10 hours of work, 9 hours of leisure, and then they slept for 9 hours. But what they found was that Kleitman's body temperature continued to fluctuate in an approximately 24-hour cycle, even lacking all external cues.
Oh!
So it kind of suggested this existence of an endogenous body clock.
Yeah.
And the University of Chicago, he notes that Kleitman is universally recognized as the father of sleep research.
Wow.
Because he would go on then to describe the sleep cycle and REM sleep, which is fascinating. But the Mammoth case study isn't the only one like this, like Tom just suggested. In 1962, Michelle Seifer spent 63 days alone in a cave in the French Alps.
What? 63 days? Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
He found that his sleep-wake cycle lengthened over that time and his perception of time became distorted.
Oh.
So this is what he told Cabinet magazine.
Oh, no.
When my surface team notified me that the day had finally arrived, I thought that it was only August 20th. I believed I still had another month to spend in the cave. My psychological time had compressed by a factor of two.
Whoa.
He observed this in himself and others, that extended periods of isolation lead to lengthening of the sleep-wake cycle, with 48 hours being the kind of cycle that cave dwellers seem to settle in.
Yeah.
And you get this kind of inaccurate time perception because of it.
Interesting. That's so weird.
Yeah, I gotta say, it brings up a really interesting concept of like self-reporting with these things. Because on the one hand, you know, with certain experiments, I can understand it's very important to be able to be the observer to it, to not be put yourself in there. But for certain experiments like this, it's extremely interesting to have the person reporting be like an involved scientist who knows about this concept, who can say things like this and speak to sort of firsthand the what it's like to come out and be like, oh, I thought I had a month. I just you ever do an experiment and then accidentally lose a month of your life?
I'll just finish this bit by saying that Seifer actually spent his birthday, his 62nd birthday, and the turn of the millennium in 2000 in a cave as part of a 70-day cave experiment.
What?
Wait, a different one?
Yeah.
At this point, hold on.
This man caves a little bit too much for my liking.
I think it seems like he probably enjoyed being in the caves. That's what I get from him.
He was like, there's no people, there's no cars.
What year was this also?
That was 1999 going into 2000.
Wow.
Oh, well, so there wasn't TikTok. So, I mean, I would spend my time in the cave if I didn't have TikTok. Yeah, that's so, yeah, that's that makes sense.
So these isolation studies, these cave studies, were really pioneering in understanding sleep cycles. And they basically kicked off an entire field of sleep study that didn't exist before.
Wow, yeah. And I guess getting other people to consent to being, like, stuck in a cave for an extended period of time is probably, like, really difficult to do, like, ethically.
Yes,
wise.
I think so. That's a very good point.
I had no idea these caves were the origin of these sort of sleep studies, because I you know, having done some research into it, they're always, like, mentioned because they're wild stories. But in some ways it makes total sense that those would be the origins, because all you have to do is bring yourself in a cave and report what happens there, I guess.
Moving on to example 3 of 4, and this is Australian physicians Barry Marshall and Robin Warren, who discovered, you know what, let me just get into it, okay?
I'm so excited.
Oh boy.
You may have heard of this one before. So around the 1980s, stomach ulcers, peptic ulcers as they're known, they affected around 10% of adults. And although they can go away on their own, if they don't, they can lead to extensive bleeding and stomach cancer and, you know, ultimately death if there's no treatment, and there is no simple treatment for them. Mm-hmm. So this is Barry Marshall from an interview in Discover magazine. Before the 20th century, the ulcer was not a respectable disease. Doctors would say, you're under a lot of stress. 19th century Europe and America had all these crazy health spas and quack treatments. By the 1880s, doctors had developed surgery for ulcers, in which they cut off the bottom of the stomach and reconnected it to the intestine. After that surgery, half the people would feel better, but about 25% of these cured patients became gastric cripples, lacking appetite and never regaining complete health.
Not great odds. Not great odds.
And this was the standard for treatment up until the 1980s, right? And further.
Oh, wow.
Was basically removal of the stomach.
That's crazy.
Marshall mentions in this interview that scientists went on to induce ulcers in rats by putting them in straitjackets and dropping them in ice water.
Oh my god. What?
So they're basically stress-induced ulcers.
Oh my.
If we could jump back 15 seconds and you gave me like a million years to guess, I never would have guessed that you were going to say that we were Criss Angel mind-freaking rats for science.
There's also like that sounds horrific for the poor animal, but I also do want to see a photo of it. You know,
I want to see the David Blaine setup where, like, they're hanging from a helicopter and there's like a rat crowd around them being like, is he going to make it? How's he going to do it this time? And he swims out. He's like, whoa.
They found out they could protect the rats from these ulcers with antacids. So they basically connected this idea of stress and stomach acid and stomach ulcers, which you've probably heard before, like the idea that stomach acid causes ulcers. But they did this without any double-blinded studies or anything. But Warren and Marshall had an alternative theory. So Warren had carried out biopsies on patients with stomach issues. From these biopsies, he found that the same shaped bacteria in about 20 patients.
Oh.
And they basically, they got another 13 patients who had confirmed duodenal ulcers, and they confirmed that there was a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori in these 13 patients. And the discovery that Helicobacter pylori could cause stomach ulcers meant that there was a very simple treatment for them already available, antibiotics.
Oh, wow.
Huh.
So instead of this extreme and dangerous stomach removal procedure, they could just treat them with antibiotics. Yeah. But when they presented their findings to the Royal Australian College of Physicians, they were sceptical, which Marshall recalls as being fair because there was already this prevailing stress theory about stomach ulcers, which was very widely accepted by the community. Although some people did believe them, it was really considered a strange idea, and their papers kept on being rejected. They needed to definitively prove the idea.
Oh, did they now?
You can't use lab mice to do it because H. pylori only affects primates.
Wow. We know where this is going because we know the topic, but still, knowing where this is going still doesn't make this any less.
You can't ethically ask someone else to infect themselves. So what did they do?
They infected themselves with it. Yay. And then tried to treat it, I assume.
Yeah. So specifically, it was just Barry Marshall. He isolated H. pylori from a patient. He grew it in some broth and drank it.
Oh my god! Like, I want you to know, when you say self-experimentation, I'm imagining Dr. Victor Frankenstein, like, drinking a potion in a lab or something like that. And, like, this is literally drinking, a poison to himself. Oh my god!
I'll let Marshall tell you what happened.
This is the best part, is hearing these scientists say firsthand, like, what is happening. I'm so excited.
My stomach gurgled, and after 5 days, I start...
I'm sorry.
Tom's lost it.
The chair lifted.
And after 5 days, I started waking up in the morning saying, oh, I don't feel good. And I'd run in the bathroom and vomit. Once I got it off my stomach, I would be good enough to go to work, although I was feeling tired and not sleeping well.
He was still going to work!
That's impressive.
Oh, just wait, guys. Wait for this kind of ending. After 10 days, I had an endoscopy that showed the bacteria were everywhere. There was all this inflammation and gastritis had developed. That's when I told my wife.
No, you didn't tell her. God, I want to know what was going through her mind when her husband was, like, vomiting every single morning. I want to know what was going through her brain.
I know.
The other thing, I'm screaming, but I'm not super surprised also.
No,
I wish scientists were less like this.
Ridiculous. Uh-huh. So, fortunately for Marshall, the patient he took the bacteria from, he'd already figured out how to treat it on that patient. Which was
a
combination of bismuth, the metal, and metronidazole, one of those, that could kill the bacteria in the lab. So he used it to treat himself.
I can see him telling this to his wife to try to reassure her. He's like, no, don't you see?
It's
fine. I already cured this in one.
I already cured it. It's okay.
Well, it completely cleared him up. So after this kind of like definitive proof, they actually still faced a lot of pushback. But the FDA eventually fast-tracked the treatment of using antibiotics as for peptic ulcers, which remains a standard today.
Oh, wow.
And 20 years later, in 2005, Marshall and Warren were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology.
Wow.
No way. Oh, that's so cool.
So it really paid off. And apparently they inspired others.
No. That's not where we want this to go.
See, because, yes, this is where we get to the it's complicated.
Because in 1981, David A. Robinson published an abstract in the British Medical Journal titled
I did this too. Look what I drank.
Titled Infective Dose of Camelobacter jejuni in Milk, in which he says, after a light breakfast, I swallowed 500 organisms of known serotype of C. jejuni in 180 ml of pasteurized milk, which was enough to infect him. The point of the study wasn't to treat it. It was to show that milk was an effective vehicle for infection of bacteria at lower doses. And he definitely did show that. So
the combination of scientific wording and the absolutely bonkers nature of like what you're describing, it's like, I totally imagine like in the participant section, they're like, spouses of experiments were chosen not to be reminded of the experiment for confidentiality purposes is why.
This particular one is wild to me because it's really just, it's like a single abstract, like a single page in a journal and then never expanded on. I couldn't find anything else about it.
And then that was it.
All that for a paragraph.
Yeah, for one page.
Yeah, basically.
Scientists will literally drink rotten milk to get a paragraph in a paper. Yeah.
That is so
pretty true.
True.
Yeah.
I'm going to end this section on a kind of theme that's been running through this. So this is from the Cabinet magazine interview. And the interviewer asks, isn't it hard for new ideas to be heard when medical journals are gatekeepers of the status quo? And Marshall says, it's true, but they have their ears pricked up now because every time a paper comes to them, they say, hang on a minute, I better make sure that this is not a Barry Marshall paper. I don't want to have my name on that rejection letter he shows in lectures. Now they might say, is it so off the wall that it's true?
Ooh.
Wow.
I love that.
I do. I love that because it is, it, you know, it reminds me of the stories we all hear about, like, Right, like Galileo saying, like, being rejected about the concept of heliocentrism. He says the line where he's like, and yet it moves, right? Where he's just like, but it's true. And mm-hmm. and to have an example of this be a living person that can, like, give you yeah. side eye and, like, has standing is really, really interesting.
Yeah, I completely agree. So before we move on to our final test subject, here are my honourable mentions.
Amazing. Oh, I love these.
In the 1960s, Stuart Adams, who was one of the pharmacologists who developed ibuprofen, first tested it on himself on his own hangover.
Amazing.
In 1954, John Paul Stapp was strapped into a rocket sled and fired along a rail reaching speeds of 631 miles per hour.
What the fuck?
Which is almost the speed of sound. Wait, wait, wait. Moving more than 3,000 feet in a few seconds and experience up to 20 G of acceleration and 46.2 G of deceleration. Stapp said it felt somewhat like the...
That was reported saying, help!
He said it felt somewhat like the extraction of a molar without any anesthetic.
Oh my god! Do we know why he did that to himself?
Yes. This was actually part of military testing. He wasn't just a thrill seeker. He did it to he did it because he wanted to improve pilot safety, especially in the cases of, like, ejection from aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's pretty cool.
That is a very that is a
more honorable.
Yeah, it feels like a similar. It's the idea of it could potentially save lives versus the idea of, like, how fast can I go?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He really kind of pioneered the field of aeromedicine as well.
Aeromedicine, yeah.
My final honorable mention is John Hunter. This is the worst of all of them, I think.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
So around the 1760s.
Just time period-wise, not great.
Physician John Hunter mistakenly hypothesized that gonorrhea was the same disease as syphilis.
Oh, no.
Just in the early stages.
Oh, no. Oh, which one did he infect himself with? Oh, no.
He infected himself with gonorrhea to see if it would turn into
amazing.
Syphilis. Okay.
Okay.
We're not done, guys. Oh. Hunter never actually confirmed that he did this to himself, by the way, but there's very strong evidence that it was him based on information about the patient and the fact that Hunter's health deteriorated after this. Appeared to be the result of a syphilitic infection.
So was he just, like, describing the patient, like, like when you say, like, my friend?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
That the patient was extremely handsome and very smart, really dedicated to his craft. It's like, oh, okay, so that's how we figured it out.
Warning for gruesome imagery, listeners.
Oh, gosh. Listeners who are squeamish, you can go ahead and skip about 10 seconds or so.
So Hunter infected himself by making cuts on his penis and applying pus from a patient with gonorrhea onto the wounds.
No, don't like it.
Unfortunately, what Hunter didn't realise was that the patient was infected with both gonorrhea and syphilis.
Well.
Oh, it could not have gone worse than that, could it? Wow. Oh, no.
But the problem here is that his hypothesis basically appeared to be correct, that gonorrhea was an early stage of syphilis because he got infected with both. So when he published his data in a treatise on the venereal disease in 1786, it's now considered that he basically set back our understanding of sexually transmitted disease by, like, several decades.
So not only did he give himself two terrible diseases, he's also attributed for setting back science by several decades.
One of those diseases he probably died of as well.
Oh, no.
So it does go to show you that self-experimentation is not always the way to go.
Yeah, I would say most of the time not the way to go in general.
Yeah, we've talked about some really great examples today, but don't do it.
So those are my honourable mentions. Real shout out to John Hunter there.
Yeah.
This is my final example, and this is David Pritchard. And I'm going to give you a big old warning at the start for the listeners. This is not for the faint of heart. It's not.
Oh, no.
If you're squeamish, it's not nice.
Anyone who's particularly squeamish about things like hookworms, you can go ahead and skip to 32 minutes and 22 seconds.
Okay, and you're going to see why. So Pritchard was carrying out fieldwork in Papua New Guinea in the 1980s, where he noted that the inhabitants that were infected with the Necator americanus hookworm did not seem to suffer from autoimmune ailments like hay fever and asthma.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
In a New York Times article, Pritchard explained his idea behind this. He said that the allergic response evolved to help expel parasites, and we think the worms have found a way of switching off the immune system in order to survive. That's why infected people have fewer allergic symptoms.
Okay. Yeah.
So they turn off the immune responses that cause things like hay fever and stuff like that?
In theory, this is still, I would say this research area is still ongoing. So this is his idea. He wanted to test if this tropical hookworm could be a potential treatment cure for allergies. So guess what he did?
Yay! Good for him.
He carefully examined first the worm and then the immune system, and then systematically thought this through and came up with a model for how it would work.
He did not infect himself with it. No, that would be a silly thing to do.
He gave himself hookworms. Unlike the other cases we've talked about, Pritchard wasn't actually trying to prove his hypothesis on himself. He actually just infected himself to prove that it was safe so he could get funding for clinical studies.
Interesting.
Okay.
So to infect himself, Pritchard put 50 hookworm larvae on his skin, on his arm.
Oh, God.
And covered them and left it there until they had penetrated the skin.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I would have that on there for like 2 minutes and then be
like, this was stupid. What am I doing?
Yeah, yeah. Well, apparently, yeah, it's very, very itchy. Then that's the main issue.
Oh, God.
I'd say there's other issues, but that is also one.
So hookworms typically infect people through the soles of their feet when they walk on like contaminated soil.
Mm-hmm.
He did it through the arm. And after this, the hookworms basically enter the bloodstream. They travel to they like nest in your heart and lungs. And then they also eventually enter your intestines, which is where they mature. And they lay eggs, which come out in your feces, which is how it's passed on.
Oy.
With 50 hookworms, Pritchard reported experienced stomach pains and diarrhea, but other members of his lab received lower doses. So he wasn't the only one. His lab did this as well, his other lab members.
It was just a real nice, like, bonding moment for them, you know?
Hey, remember that time?
Yeah. But they had lower doses, and they basically determined that 10 hookworms was asymptomatic. In 2006, Pritchard recruited 30 participants to a clinical trial, 15 of which were infected with 10 hookworms each. And it was basically reported that T cells, which is a type of immune cell, were producing fewer pro-inflammatory chemicals in the recipients of the hookworms, indicating that the immune system was being suppressed. And the participants also reported fewer allergy symptoms.
Mm.
Wow.
There have also been other clinical trials in this area since by both Pritchard and other scientists and companies. So in 2011, for example, the pharmaceutical company Coronado Biosciences ran 6 clinical trials with the parasitic roundworm Tichuris ticuria, which is known as whipworm. Mm. But when the first study found no success in Crohn's disease, they basically terminated most of the studies early. And as recently as 2020, Pritchard was the author on paper titled Hookworm Treatment for Relapsing Multiple Sclerosis, a Randomized Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Trial. And they basically reported that the treatment was safe and well-tolerated in 66 patients with multiple sclerosis. And they saw an increase in T regulatory cells, which are the ones that also kind of dampen the immune system. So that's where this research seems to be at the moment, kind of slowly testing it for different diseases. Not quite as thrilling an end as the others, but I think equally important in demonstrating the actual normal scientific process. He started it out like this, but it's carried on in a very systematic way.
And it's carried on for quite a long time now as well, which is equally very cool.
Whether or not hookworms or any kind of parasitic worm actually can treat allergies, still left to be said. But there is somewhat of a cautionary tale here as well. And this is the tale of Jasper Lawrence, a California man who suffered from crippling allergies. He saw a documentary on Pritchard's work and decided to treat himself. He infected himself with hookworms. And the thing is, he claims it completely cured his allergies. Which
amazing.
Is great,
good for him,
fine.
But
But the problem is he went on then to sell the larva of his own hookworms to people with allergies and like Crohn's disease.
Oh.
Oh my God. No.
Yeah.
No.
So when the FDA found out about it, they obviously shut it down. Because
of course. Yeah.
Hookworm infections can lead to severe complications. So they were very, very right to do this. And as we come to the end, I don't think I need to say this really to you guys, but please don't infect yourself with hookworms.
Yeah. No, don't do it. No.
Nobody do it.
Dwight Douglas Bowman, a professor of parasitology at Cornell University, said about a different case of a different scientist infecting himself with hookworms, being a person who has spent most of my career making sure people and animals don't get worms, it seems like this is going in the wrong direction. We don't want to put other people and the environment at risk. If you give yourself too many, you can get sick. They can cause serious anemia. For a successful pharmaceutical trial, you would need to test a lot of people. And I don't want to give 10,000 people hookworm.
Yeah, I
valid, you know.
Well, yeah, I think most of us would agree with that opinion.
What
at the
a
end
novel
there.
Idea! Yeah, right? I don't want to give 10,000 people.
I'm weighing the options between 10,000 giving 10,000 people hookworms. I will say, you know, there is sort of the alternative idea that there are other ways to test these theories besides necessarily these self-experimentation things.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and the success of them shouldn't preclude us from thinking about it in a different way.
Yes. I want to be clear here. I left out a bunch where people just died doing self-experimentation. There's been loads of examples of people just dying after doing self-experimentation. These are, I like these because, you know, they had a kind of story behind them, but
yeah,
it's a possible way to do things. It's not the first port of call.
No, yeah,
you know, I think going back to the very first example, you know, in some ways self-experimentation is a very natural thing to be able to like have a question and, you know, answer them in a way that if you want to experiment with like what you eat or like how much you exercise or something like that, or put yourself in a cave for a few months. But it is very interesting where this sits in the scheme of scientific progress.
I mean, I will say I do think that these are very important stories, particularly like people like Santorio. And Marshall and Warren, you know, for me, those ones, some of these are like, you know, wacky things to do, but a lot of them are not just fun stories about eccentric scientists performing like displays of masochism. Yeah. You know, they are often demonstrations of new approaches to research, like pioneers in their field of medicine and like challenging the status quo. But obviously, all that being said, please don't try this at home.
I also just don't think I've ever cared about my career so much that I'd be willing
to
do any of this.
I don't think it's about caring about your career. I think it's that they genuinely care about the science.
Yeah.
Like they really, like with Marshall and Warren, like they were clinicians who were seeing people die from something that was
very treatable. Yeah.
And that's where this idea of self-experimentation to me becomes like more of a, this was really a necessity to them.
Yeah, a much more valid course of action, especially if like they weren't getting anywhere with other means. Mm. That makes a lot of sense. I like that, yeah.
I think also as the scientific method is being developed and sort of standards and practices and our understandings of what can go wrong with self-experimentation becomes more understood, it's probably less necessary as time goes on, would be my thought personally.
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think so, absolutely.
It is really interesting how a lot of the like the good examples start off sounding very silly, but then when you understand their prior research beforehand and their background and the reason why they're doing it specifically is very specific and like has a scientific purpose, as opposed to just being like a whim. It is a hypothesis and is something that is thought out, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you know, you give yourself syphilis and gonorrhea at the same time, so.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, hi, I'm Dave Holmes, host of the pop culture trivia podcast, Troubled Waters. On Troubled Waters, we play games like motivational speeches. And it goes a little like this. Riley, give us an improvised motivational speech on why people should listen and subscribe to Troubled Waters.
I look around this ad and I see a lot of potential to listen to comedians such as Jackie Johnson and Josh Gondelman, and they need you to get out there and listen to them attempt to figure out sound rebus clues or determine if something is a Game of Thrones character or a city in Wales.
I have chills. I'm going to give you 15 points. All that and so much more on Troubled Waters. Find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you choose to listen to podcasts.
Question is, when was or when did the oldest human limb amputation take place? I'm not going to say anything immediately. I just want to hear what your guesses might be.
I want to say that I think that this is, when is the oldest recorded amputation take place? Because I think it's probably happened more than we could possibly know.
That's a great point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe not even recorded example, but oldest example that we might have dug out of the ground could be a good way of phrasing that one.
Yeah
so the oldest that we know of,
that we are currently aware of. Yeah
Which means, Caroline, you just kind of given it away a bit there, it means that it's not necessarily written records.
No, it's 1992, weirdly. we dug it up. It was a very recent thing.
I reckon it's been happening for thousands of years, because every time you do it, when is the oldest, it's like I guess like 500 years. Like, always guess 500 years, and then you're like, it was 20,000 years ago before man even existed, you know. I'm going for ancient Egypt.
Ooh, interesting that you should say that.
Is it really? I could have placed it any, I can imagine it happening like in the Americas, in Asia and Europe, because there's no, it seems like a universal human thing where it's just like
a universal human thing to chop off limbs.
It's a universal truth.
If it was like a limb that had been crushed or something, I can see that being universal there, but I feel like people didn't necessarily understand medicine enough to know that, like,
that's,
if your limb was like rotting from like gangrene or something, you wouldn't necessarily have known that to stop that.
The concept of,
you should have
right,
cut it off, but maybe they did. In their own non-medical text way.
Yeah.
You know, that is
I'm
a good
this.
Point.
So I'm going to hone in on the ancient Egypt shout, because I guessed that one of you two were going to say ancient Egypt, basically.
It's because you always say ancient Egypt,
and I
Caroline.
Always start there, don't I? You know me too well.
Listen, they kept great records.
They did. They really did. And one of my favorite examples that I came across whilst researching this topic was in ancient Egypt. These are a large group of individuals who were excavated from Giza Necropolis, and they belonged to the Old Kingdom. So they were dated to be around 2700 to 2190 BC. That's about 4,000 years ago.
Okay.
And there are two specific individuals that I want to talk about, one of whom was a high official male, a man of status, basically, who had an amputation on his right tibia and fibula. There was also another male, a male worker, who also had an amputation in the left ulna and radius. Whilst we have evidence that the higher ranking male possibly used something like a prosthetic or a walking aid or something like that.
No way, a prosthetic.
Yeah. We also know that based on the patterns of healing in these two individuals, that they would have received pretty much equal amounts of care during and after.
What a concept.
Crazy, right?
Surely this is because of the idea that the highest level of care was not that high.
Possibly.
That's an interesting concept. the roof, the ceiling of care.
I think there possibly could have been worse. Well, I mean, the worst standard of care possibly for this man would have been that he died for the working man.
Of course, yeah.
Great
but
point.
Like,
yeah.
If you, but
great
if,
point.
But if the most you can do in ancient Egypt is keep the wound clean, you know, then I feel like both of those people could have received the same standard of care.
Can I ask, so are these like analyses of the corpse, or are there like records that are being kept?
These are analyses of the corpses themselves. There are no like written records of these individuals. So we would have like ascertain that they were like high ranking or lower ranking based on what was buried with them. And that's a theme in right. this. But yeah, so for these two individuals, mm-hmm. they both received the same amount of care and they both survived the surgery. So they both went on to live
that's
for
amazing.
A period of time afterwards as well. So that's really, really cool. And I liked that example.
I think I really underestimate like the level of medical knowledge that human beings have carried throughout history.
Yeah.
When I think about medical history, I like look back to like the 1700s where I think things got a lot worse.
Yeah.
Before they got particularly in like Western cultures before they got okay again. But then before that, when people were doing like holistic treatments and kind of more natural way of like just like intuitive treatments, I almost think that that was a lot better before things started getting like real crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. People started doing. People started like self-experimenting and things like that. You know, it started to get real strange after that.
Some people, let's just say, they set back medical history a little bit, but they were very handsome. And they were going to experiment, the records say.
So that's a really cool example of amputations taking place, but it wasn't the first successful limb removal that we have record of.
Okay, wait. You can't tell us. It's a question topic.
I'm not going to. Don't worry. My next question.
Farther back than 4,000 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That's wild.
Much farther? Okay, yeah, please.
We'll see. So the first thing I want to do is sort of... I have a feeling that some people who are listening are going to be like looking at that question and being like, what is the definition of a human in this example?
Wait.
Are we going that far back?
We're going a little bit back. But my next question for you guys is going to be, what is the definition of a human?
Homo sapien.
You're wrong.
You're saying not that, correct. Like, what is it? Neanderthals. Are they considered human?
So it's anything in the Homo genus is considered a human, basically.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
So... Homo sapiens have existed for around 300,000 years, but we are not the only species under the human bracket. The first species under the human bracket, I believe, is...
Homo erectus.
Homo erectus was our, like, most recent ancestor. Homo habilis is the oldest human that we are aware of. I want to bring this up because this is more of a tangent for me, really, because you might have seen recently that... A 1.8 million year old human tooth was discovered in Georgia.
1.8 million year.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know what? I did hear about this because I saw a tweet which said a 1.8 million year old tooth has been discovered in Georgia, the country, not the state. And then someone underneath that tweeted, Georgia is a state in the United States, not a country.
How far we've come across 2 million years, how much we've advanced.
The other thing that I've seen online is that some creators have been claiming that the discovery of this tooth has changed like how we view human evolution, because they're interpreting the discovery of this tooth as discovering a Homo sapien tooth, which obviously is not what it is. I believe it was a Homo habilis tooth.
Oh man, I can see conspiracy TikTok going wild. Yeah. Dentistry existed 2 million years ago. No, but that kind of clarification is very interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have an intuition that like those time scales, because you know we've talked about these human time scales so much on the podcast alone that like when you say a human tooth from 1.8 million years. Alarm bells go off in my head that like those don't match up, but I don't have the detailed knowledge that human means anyone in the Homo genus.
That's the thing. And like if you are somebody who's just like not science literate at all, right, and you're seeing these headlines, it's so easy to be like, wow, this really does change like everything
that's
we know
really
about humans. And actually like we do use the term human a lot more loosely than just describing us, and I think that's a really important clarification.
I had no idea, so like that would have even I consider myself reasonably scientifically literate, And I think that would, I would have been like confused by that. So it's very telling about how difficult it is to maneuver around this information.
Definitely, yes.
And also the intersection between common language and scientific language, right? Mm, because I mean, you know, I you can make an argument that it's confusing that human means both like us and then also the genus. But I will say, I don't want to diminish the fact that it probably is an amazing discovery. It's just one of those things where it's like, it's smaller than we think it is, but it's still amazing that, like, to find this.
Even, okay, so it is amazing that we found this tooth. However, in Georgia, it's a bit of a hotspot for finding human remains of age. So I'm aware that we have found things like skulls and stuff like that. It just seems that this tooth, for some reason, has really sparked something
just
online.
Took off. The tooth heard round the world.
So I do not know why this
is
one.
Is it even the oldest like remains found in that area?
No. So it's the oldest remains in that area, but the oldest Homo habilis remains we found, I believe, are around 2.6 million years old.
Crazy. Wow. So that's so interesting that this has taken off.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine that Homo habilis losing that tooth and being like, this is going to be
this
a banger, and just planting in the ground. I mean, let's be like, it's not even the oldest. I'm like, no, I got a hunch. This one's going to go viral.
I say that every time I lose a tooth, which is a lot because of all the fights I get into. I say that.
The scientific fights you get into.
So I will tell you now that we've made that clarification about what we mean, we are in fact talking about Homo sapiens in this example.
Okay, good.
I just wanted to throw that in there for anybody who has seen this story recently, just to clear that thing up.
Appreciate
it. It is really, really interesting. Cool. So what we have done now is we have whittled down the like period of time that you can guess between, which is 4,800 years and 300,000 years.
Oh, 300. I was about to ask, when did Homo sapiens first appear? Yeah. You're saying 300,000. So I would make a guess that it's 300,000 years. That is the first. No,
ooh,
okay.
Okay, yeah.
No, okay, maybe that's too far. All right, whatever it is, it happened in Africa.
I was going to say, are you just picking somewhere on the map to
no,
for
that's
this
just
guess?
Where Homo sapiens like arose, right? That was the first
place
that we know they're from. So I would assume it happened there because it took a very long time to migrate out of Africa.
Absolutely.
The sticky wicket with this is the fact that I would assume, and maybe you're going to talk about this, like finding enough evidence to support the fact that this is definitely a amputation involves a very, you can't just find like a femur and be like, this was amputated, right? You have to have
can you not because I think that the signs of amputation are very clear. Like the cuts, like a deliberate cut in a bone, it has to be surely very obvious that it was deliberately cut while they were living as well, because
that's
there's a difference between cutting a dead bone versus a living bone in the way it heals.
That's so
and also maybe looking for patterns in growth afterwards. And
I've never been more excited to be wrong about something. I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. I am wrong.
Like there's like a whole science, you know, it's the science of forensic anatomy. There's based on this idea of like looking at patterns in damage. And I feel like I did a little bit of this in my undergraduate degree. I feel like there was a very clear way of knowing if something was cut when they were alive.
I will say thousands of years, probably also potentially hundreds of thousands of years, probably doesn't make it easier, but that is a good point.
Yeah,
I haven't considered that.
Definitely. But we can at least see things like if the bone was crushed or not, which is often how limbs were being lost if it wasn't being amputated.
Yeah.
You can see stuff like that pretty clearly. So that's like at least a good place to start for a lot of these things, which is also really interesting. Shall we whittle down that time period that it could have been in a little bit more?
Yes, please.
Next question for you both is going to be, when do you think the first surgery in general happened? When do you think we have the earliest evidence of surgeries happening? Oh, there's so many thinking faces going on right now.
Surgery. Okay, so I reckon so super, super early. Well, it depends, because I feel like if we want evidence of it to still persist, then it would have to be in bone, right? Because it's the only thing that doesn't that would remain for long enough. Because I reckon there are things like, you know, there could be things like surgery where you cut through intestines or like into the stomach or something like that, or into like muscle where it wouldn't show in remains. And that probably is very, very old. Surgery would it would have to be a bone based surgery then. I don't know. But I think that I made a great point there, and everyone should acknowledge that.
You absolutely made a fantastic point there. You're going to feel really good.
I
when
showed
you're
my work.
Right, yeah. Tom,
I think I think to Ella's point, my assumptions are these are closer to the 300,000 end than the ancient Egypt end of things.
Okay, yeah. So you're both maybe thinking a little bit too far away.
Okay.
So we think it was conducted around 10,000 BC. So about 12,000
really far
years
away.
Okay. Yeah. For now, yeah. Can you guess what that surgery might have been?
Something to do with pregnancy.
No.
Oh, interesting. That's a
really
great
good
thought.
Guess. Yeah.
I don't know then.
My thought.
Trepanning?
Yes. Yes, Ella.
Wait, what? What did you say?
Trepanation is the answer.
No.
I had this written down as a topic to do one day.
We're not going to go too far into it, so you definitely can still do it. But Ella, can you tell us what trepanation is, or trepanning is?
It's drilling, or, you know, opening up a hole or several into the skull.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For many, many reasons.
So many reasons.
Spiritual reasons, it might be. For psychiatric treatment, which is obviously terrible. For releasing pressure, which is like the more authentic reason it's done. Not anymore, but maybe before we understood how to do that in other ways.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm familiar with trepanation through the other Max Fun show, Sawbones, where they end every episode by saying, "Don't drill a hole in your head." which is great advice. But I didn't know what the reason I'm so shocked is the fact that I don't know, that feels so advanced. Like, amputation seems much more intuitive to me of a surgery than
I completely agree.
Than trepanation. But there is also the issue of the fact that these are imperfect records, right? And in some ways, trepanation, to Ella's point about other types of surgery, trepanation is a very visible surgery.
That's the other thing.
It's a hole in a skull. Yeah. That's a great,
So obviously it's a really, really great one in that we have so many examples of it as well throughout a really, really long period of time.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things which...
That's also a great point.
It makes sense that this is one of the earliest examples that we're aware of right now, because it's such an obvious thing. Like, if you find a skull... and it has a hole in it.
you're gonna be like, okay. Someone didn't listen to Sawbones. Yeah.
But also for these early examples as well, they used to create these holes by shaving down on the skull. So there'd be very obvious markings on the skull to sort of demonstrate that it was a very deliberate move.
I hope these people were sleeping.
You would hope so, wouldn't you? But it does highlight things like we had a lot of these people survived as well. There are some estimates that around 50% of people would survive this surgery.
50 is so still, would you do it but if the odds were that low?
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, a lot of the times where this was happening, it was because of head injuries.
And existing.
Yeah. So if you've already got a fractured skull, how can it get much worse, right?
Yeah, I mean, for the time of 10,000 BC, if you have a head injury where you've got fluid buildup in the brain and the only way to release it is by trepanning, fair enough.
Go for it. What, you're either going to die or maybe not die. So... does that maybe influence your guesses for the final time how long ago we might have been amputating limbs?
We got 10,000 and 3,000.
8,000 BC.
You're going 8,000?
Okay, I'm gonna... analyze Caroline's reaction. I won't.
Caroline's very good at not reacting to these things.
Thank you.
And I can't tell if the delight in their face is because you're on the money or completely off.
Yeah.
I can't tell.
Yeah, I love the idea. You're wrong, and I love that.
I'm tempted to go the other way just because I was so wrong with the assumption that it would be closer to 100,000 years old. I'll say around 5,000 BC.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So between 4,900 and 4,700 BC is when we think the earliest.
Well done, Tom,
one.
But that's so late. Right. That's so late. If people are trepanning in 10 to 12,000 BC.
So that was 10,000 BC, so 12,000 years ago.
Oh, I see. But it took another 6,000 years to start cutting off limbs. or that we know of, at least.
Crazy,
that seems strange. That,
yeah.
That seems really odd.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The skeleton was discovered in France. It was discovered not far away from Paris.
Oh, interesting.
And the site itself where the body was found was identified in 2003. And I believe the remains were found not long after that. The paper discussing this theory was published in 2007. So if you're looking for it in the show notes, it's not going to be 2003, it'll be 2007. The skeleton itself was of an aged man, and the amputated limb showed real signs of recovery.
Wow.
Suggesting that he survived the surgery, which is really, really cool. I believe it was his leg that was amputated. On top of that, the team had the following to say about his grave, which was, in addition, the associated grave goods were original, including the skeleton of an animal, a polished axe, and a massive 30-centimeter long flint pick.
Wow.
Despite the serious handicap from which he suffered in this pastoral agricultural community, the buried man obviously enjoyed some particular social status and suggested the remarkable and prestigious accompanying grave goods.
Wow.
If indeed this man benefited from some form of community care, which would indicate the level of social solidarity in Western Europe almost 7,000 years ago.
Wow.
How cool is that, right? Now, 7 days ago, that was the end of my script.
And then I found this bone in queue.
then this paper got published. I believe on the 7th of September.
Get out of town.
Yeah. Which then meant that I had to add this onto the end of the script, which is really, really cool. Essentially what happened was they found an older skeleton. This earliest example of a limb removal is 31,000 years old.
Okay.
Which completely like threw this out of the water. I was like, oh yeah, 7,000 years. We've gone through all of this really cool stuff.
Right, we're narrowing it down.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
You have and to then, zoom out again to be like, actually.
By the way, that's all completely wrong. And it was actually about 20,000 years later than
actually, Caroline, you'll notice that me and Ella were very careful about our wording, and we kept saying things like that we know of.
Holding it in and not telling me. So these human remains were discovered in 2020 in Borneo. Early human remains are scarce in the region, so the authors suggested that this might be the oldest known burial of a modern human that has been found in the region, which is really, really cool.
This has just triggered something in my brain. The term modern human is the term, I realised now, is the term we use for Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
Right, versus human. Yeah. Modern human is the differential, I feel.
That's the thing, yeah, yeah.
I never noticed that before.
Which, you know, really, really using the term modern in a relative sense in terms of the chronology of Earth history.
Yeah. 300,000 years in the chronology of Earth history is incredibly modern.
Yeah, but also 300,000 years old.
300,000 years ago.
I don't think the iPhone 1 is modern even.
So, during the dig, the team discovered that the skeleton that they had found, its lower leg was completely missing on one side. I think it was on its left leg. This is more specifically the distal third of their left lower leg. I did put it in the script. Amazing. The limb had not been broken or smashed, but it had been cleanly removed. And the archaeologists found an unusual bony overgrowth on the remaining fragment of the tibia and fibula, which matched overgrowths we see now in modern amputations, which again suggests that it definitely was an amputation. Scientists believe that the patient lived for around 6 to 9 years after it had had this amputation happen.
Mm-hmm.
They also believe that this was the body of a 19-year-old male. So he would have been a child when this amputation happened and then lived for a further 6 years.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to forget that children are running around during this time and are as much a part of this sort of like medical history and anthropological history as
that's the,
you know,
thing,
the cave people that you picture in your head.
Yeah, and they were,
I don't know, was 13 a child 30,000 years ago? I reckon that was
But if they're still Homo sapiens, then they are still going through puberty. That's still, that's
very
hasn't
true.
Changed.
Very, very true.
Just didn't have, you know, MySpace to vent and stuff like that, or My Chemical Romance. So
silly. So
that's the sequel to comedy.
Silly.
The amputation suggests that at least some foragers of Southeast Asia had developed significant medical knowledge and techniques long before the Neolithic Revolution, which was around 12,000 years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a great point.
And of course, this includes things when you're doing a leg amputation of understanding where the bones are, pretty easy one, but also where the muscles are, where the blood vessels are already as well, so that you're not severing them and causing the person to bleed out, essentially. Which is sort of stuff that I think we often attribute to ancient Egypt and ancient Greeks, is figuring out these parts of our anatomy. We possibly would have known it at least 31,000 years ago, which is absolutely wild to me.
Yeah.
To Ella's point, it is interesting because I feel like we so often attribute these to like the first time it's like written in a book, kind of like a thing.
Exactly,
And there is something to that. But to Ella's point that you made earlier, it's like there was knowledge. It may not have been as in the same system of science as we have, but there could have been. I forget the word you used, but some cultural understanding
Maybe
these scientific, basic scientific things.
And that these things would have been passed on as well. So would have been spoken about and shown to other members of the community too, which is so cool. So the authors on the paper itself say, our understanding of this aspect of Homo sapiens prehistory, however, may be affected by poor preservation of pathological bone, as was mentioned earlier, but also as well as by preconceptions about the primitive nature of earlier medico-socio-cultural practices, especially among non-sedentary foraging populations in tropical Asia. And that's just bonkers to me. And I'm so pissed off that this paper got released now, basically.
Well, I will say I you almost couldn't have asked for I love that happened, because it does reinforce the thing that we've been saying this whole time, which is that like there are these caveats to it, and we are sort of figuring this out, and this process of this anthropology of it, that like we've been saying this whole time, it's like, well, it could be older, but this is the most recent one we have so far, and this just emphasizes that again, that like it's a process.
There was a really cool thing that I sort of skipped out, but I will briefly touch on now, which is, so once I found out this thing, I was like, are there any other sort of like indicators that we might have been doing surgery before that point, like surgery that I used earlier? There is tentative evidence that we were amputating the ends of people's fingers in a ritual format around 33,000 years ago. And the way that we know that is through like handprints that you see on the walls and things like that, of like people making handprints.
Interesting.
Or like outlines of hands, which is really, really cool. And what they were seeing was literally that I think it was the ring finger was physically shorter than it should have been, which I think is also really, really cool. But it's really difficult to say if that is evidence of it or not, or if it was just deterioration of the handprints. But it's still so cool.
It goes to show you that there's so much, like there's just too much missing in our understanding of that. In the same way, you know, we were saying before about, you know, we can only show bone-based surgery as evidence. There was surely plenty of other things going on.
Definitely.
And as I was saying, like, I have this assumption in my head that things were more primitive than they were, but that's just probably not the case. It was just very different. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Just figuring out these like anthropological clues about like handprint, like when you hear it, you're just like, oh, it's so clever.
It's so cool.
It is. In that last quote you said, that concept of our preconceived notions, like to Ella's point, it is really interesting, and how that can hinder our understanding if we have
if we
think of these things as like hard demarcated lines, like first surgery happened then, first amputation happened then, instead of being open to the fact that it could change. We could find out that which is so interesting.
Definitely. Thank you so much, guys. I really enjoyed talking about human bones with you.
I was expecting to like hear a year and be like, that's cool, but now you've got me thinking about like archaeological mysteries now.
Yeah,
and
what else has been going on for far longer than we thought it had been, you know?
Ugh,
cool.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Travelle Anderson.
And I'm Jared Hill. We are the hosts of Fanti, the show where we have complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the things that we really, really love sometimes, but also have some problematic feelings about.
Yes, we get into it all. You want to know our thoughts about Nicki Minaj and all her foolishness? We got you. You want to know our thoughts about gentrification and perhaps some positive aspects of gentrification? We get into that too. Every single Thursday, you can check us out at MaximumFun.org. Listen, you know you want it, honey, so come on and get it. Period.
Today's miscellaneous topic. I love when the miscellaneous topic is so different from the science of the question. It truly makes me so happy. Today's miscellaneous topic is PowerPoint.
This is like, Tom, this is silly. It's giving me real triangle vibes.
I will say, unlike the triangle, I'm sure y'all are intimately familiar with PowerPoint. Like, how do y'all feel about it?
So much so.
I know a lot of people hate PowerPoint. I like it.
Yeah. You know what?
It's a nice way to get information across. I don't just use it for, like, giving presentations, especially when you're a scientist. There needs to be a way to, like, put your data, especially your figures, in a way that is, like, easy to just go through.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to be, like, look great. So, like, that's a nice way to do it, is just to have slides of your data.
One of my favorite things as well is on TikTok, is people doing the silly PowerPoint presentations. They're one of my favorite things to watch on TikTok. Like, I love them so much.
For example, one of my earlier hit TikTok videos, which was me doing a presentation, a PowerPoint about that's not how you use a pipette.
Yes! Oh, I loved that so much.
An oldie but a goodie. So we will definitely get into some more of the opinions, love for, and modern usages of PowerPoint in a bit. So I would love to hear some more shouts later. But I just want to briefly talk about the history, only because
the history of PowerPoint, of course, goes back to 3000 BC when the ancient Egyptians.
Okay, hold on. No, how do you know I wrote ancient China in my joke? So I'm not that predictable. delete. I will say it's especially interesting with this because I feel like we all grew up using it, and so it can be easy to forget a time when it was still kind of figuring itself out as opposed to being such a standard, right?
Yeah.
So PowerPoint dates back to ancient China with the Point Dynasty. And that's okay.
I think I already that joke. Sorry.
Yeah, I was. Well, now it's a callback, so that's how comedy works, right? So PowerPoint launched in 1987, and even from the very start, it is a mess. Robert Gaskins was one of the creators of PowerPoint, and he wrote a book about the history of PowerPoint titled "Sweating Bullets." Great pun, because like bullets. Bullets on a slide. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
But also encapsulates the chaos of it all. And in 2012, for the blog InDesign, he recalls the origin of the name, which is something I've always wondered. And that story emblemizes the chaos of this like early computer world launch. Can you y'all guess how the name came about?
Something point bullet points. No, that's it. Yeah, that's all I got.
Like, yeah.
Was it made for Microsoft? Was it made for Microsoft of interest? Or was
so
it...
we're going to get to it, but it originally was made by a startup and then Microsoft acquired it.
Okay.
It hasn't got anything to do with like laser pointers pointing at the board or anything, does it?
That's a great thought. Apparently, the company that made it, Forethought, they had originally settled on the name Presenter. For years.
Terrible.
Makes sense. Don't like it, but it makes sense.
But at the last minute, their lawyers realized someone had already filed that trademark.
Oh, no.
So Robert Gaskins describes, "The pressure was high because we were about to ship. Then, one morning, when I was taking a shower, where most of history's great discoveries seems to have occurred, I thought of the name PowerPoint for no obvious reason. I went into work and proposed it to other people. No one else much liked it. But I became attached to it." Then, later that same day, Glenn Hoban, our VP of sales, returned from a sales trip, and he had an idea for a name, When his airplane was taking off, he had seen out the window along the runway a sign reading PowerPoint.
So, what? The universe.
No.
The great meaning of the universe all converges back on one thing, and that thing is PowerPoint.
Maybe I do believe in God.
He was like, it must be so.
It has to be PowerPoint.
Yeah, and then a burning bush just kept saying the word PowerPoint over and over. He goes, I took his independent discovery as a favorable omen, and we were truly out of time, so I forced the issue, and we sent the name PowerPoint off to our lawyers. Which I guess is a better name than calling it Baggage Claim or Hudson News. Clearly the name worked, because a week after launching, they were bought out by Microsoft for $36 million in today's dollars, accounting for inflation, which also,
I don't know, that's not that much. Tumblr was bought for $1 billion.
Was Tumblr bought for $1 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I will say what is interesting is this is the early times of these kinds of acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And actually, in point, it was Microsoft's first big acquisition of all time.
Well, they saw something good and they took it. Was it, you say, the 80s or the 90s at this point?
This was 1987 was when it was made, and a week later bought out. I mean, Microsoft now goes on to buy anything they can.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was their first big acquisition, which is really interesting. And as the New York Times reported, Forethought makes a program called PowerPoint that allows users of Apple Macintosh computers to make, how would you describe it?
Presentations.
A PowerPoint presentation.
Overhead transparencies or flip charts.
Flip charts? Like, I get it, but you're wrong.
Well, this may be totally obvious to our older listeners, but as someone who grew up with PowerPoint as we know today,
an overhead transparency is where you put the sheet on the light thing. And then you've like, and it like projects it on the wall.
Originally, PowerPoint just made printable transparency.
Oh my God, of course. And I will say,
yeah.
I know you say older listeners, but my early school days, we still use these.
Likewise, yeah.
Caroline's too young, apparently, to know. Do you know what we're talking about, Caroline?
I have no.
It's like a TikTok that you project through a device.
Do you really not know what we're talking about?
No,
you're like 3 years younger than us. This is insane.
What are you talking about?
So it's like a transparent piece of paper with writing on. So you can like, often people just write on it themselves, and then you put it on a deck with a light that shines through, and a projector like picks up the image and reflects it on a wall, I think is the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
So my lecturer did this once with a bug. Where he just put the bug on the thing and it projected it onto the wall. But that's, I mean, like the only...
Yeah, that's it. Really quickly, any of our listeners who are older than 25, I'm going to need you to roll 3d8 of psychic damage real quick.
I'm so sorry, everyone.
Caroline, you're a child.
I can't. This feels like, you know when older people are like, do you even know what a floppy disk is? Do you know what the save button is? And like...
I guess, oh my God, I'm an old person now who says, do you even know what a floppy disk is?
I want to contextualize that era of computing a little bit more, because one of PowerPoint's features when it launched was the fact that it could store multiple slides in a single file.
Whoa, no way.
What a concept.
What a crazy thing.
It wasn't until 5 years later in 1992 that PowerPoint could produce visual output.
Oh.
And that's when it became more than just a brand name and became a word for all digital presentations. And with that ubiquity came a lot of hate. And it can sometimes be hard to cite something to prove that like it's generally disliked, but fortunately for me writing this topic, it has enough hate that I can actually quote people who have written articles about how much they hate PowerPoint.
What? People need to find better things to do with their time.
Well, I know, really.
Perhaps the most prolific opponent of PowerPoint is also one of the bigger names in the social and computer sciences, and his name is Edward Tufte. In the data visualization world, he's like an unavoidable name. Mm-hmm. I think he's a tad overrated. That's a topic.
Shots fired, Tom.
Yeah, shots fired, Edward Tufte. Come down here and fight Tom Lumperson.
That's a debate for another topic, but one thing that is not debatable is his hate for PowerPoint. So in 2003, Tufte wrote an article for Wired magazine titled, PowerPoint is Evil. with the subtitle "Power Corrupts, PowerPoint Corrupts Absolutely."
But, I mean, that's funny.
That is, it is funny. But I've never cared about anything so much.
I mean, I didn't laugh. I just said that's funny, so probably that funny. But
well, you do that with my jokes, so it is. It must be funny. Anyway, yeah. the very first paragraph of this article. Oh boy, it reads, quote, "Imagine a widely used and expensive prescription drug that promised to make us beautiful, but didn't. Instead, the drug had frequent serious side effects. It induced stupidity, turned everyone into bores, wasted times, and degraded the quality and credibility of communication.
Oh, come on.
These side effects would rightly lead to a worldwide product recall. Yet, computer programs for presentations is everywhere."
I just don't... I get it. Like, I understand why you might have an issue with the way that, like, data or, like, information is presented through PowerPoint sure. presentations, through any slide deck, like, software. Yeah. I've firsthand experienced many slideshows that are bad oh, in yeah. my life. Uh-huh. But that doesn't change the fact that, like, it's given people a platform to express that's information exactly in a way that's hadn't been done before yeah. or available before. So if Edward Tufte is going to complain about it, he needs to come up mm-hmm. with a solution.
Well,
agreed.
And does he in this article? Well,
so it's very interesting. First of all, I gotta say, it's a really evocative metaphor, but I want to point out two things. First, in 2019, Tom Lumperson went to an Edward Tufte class that he got his employer to pay for. And the thing is, the fucker still uses PowerPoint in his presentation.
No.
Bitch.
No. No. He doesn't.
That's embarrassing for him.
Well, this will clear it up a bit more, because the second thing is, this is something I recommend you do. I love to do this with like any inflammatory article, is you read the first and the last paragraphs to see how much their opinion has changed by the end. So mm-hmm. when you get to the last paragraph of the article, this is what Tufte has to say. "Practical conclusions are clear. PowerPoint is a competent slide manager and projector, but rather than supplementing a presentation, has become a substitute for it. Such misuse ignores the most important rule of speaking, respect your audience," which is a real backing down.
It is, and it's a valid point, but he also like ignores the fact that like not in a world where everyone has to present their information in some way, not everyone is a natural yeah. speaker.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And for them, it's not a supplement. It is the present. It mm-hmm. is the whole thing. And that is just the case. That's never going to change. Like in the current world.
That's a really interesting.
I get he was writing it a lot earlier than it's now ubiquitous, mm-hmm. yeah. right? But, you know, people who are natural speakers will use it to supplement and will use themselves as the tool
that's
to
a really
capture
great
information.
Point.
But most people yeah. won't.
It's almost like there are more PowerPoint presentations in the world, which means the majority of them are worse. But it's not because presenters have gotten worse. It's more people have become presenters, right? Sort
yeah.
of like
everyone is a presenter now, yeah. which I don't think is a bad thing.
No, it's made this thing accessible to a lot more people, which is always yeah. a
which
good
which is something
thing.
We're going to get to.
And like, yeah. you can't bash PowerPoint for that. You know, that's like, why are you yeah. bashing PowerPoint?
Well, yeah. clearly he didn't by the end of the yeah, article. That's true. So.
I don't think any of us would like fully disagree with him that like there are some practices in it that make for bad presenting.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know, I just think that Edward Tufte's opinions could use some improvement. But I guess if I was writing the article like he did, I would say Edward Tufte is evil. Right, joking aside, and I think you guys have touched on this, like, what bothers me about Tufte's argument is the focus on the medium over the larger system.
Yeah.
Right? I've seen, having worked corporate jobs, I've seen lots of arguments against PowerPoint that sound like, they're like, if we didn't use PowerPoint, productivity would be boosted like 1,000%, right? And they're asking the question, like, why do we use PowerPoint or what can we do to improve, instead of asking the question, why don't companies and schools have the time to use alternatives, right?
Yeah.
Like, what are the bigger reasons at play here? Is your company beholden to an unfeasible culture of productivity?
Mm-hmm.
Is your school pressed for funds? It reminds me of, like, the culture of, like, shaming individuals for buying unhealthy foods, when
yeah.
it's like, chances are there are bigger systems that are the problem. Mm-hmm. Like, why don't people have the financial mm-hmm. choice for healthier options? Why are companies allowed to make unhealthy foods so cheap? And, you know, to borrow Tufte's exact metaphor of a drug recall, the only reason product recalls happen is because there are bigger systems in place that hold people accountable and think about these bigger issues than just like what people use. And you know, I think a lot of people are already aware of this nuance that like PowerPoint itself isn't the problem.
I mean, everyone I've talked to about this knows that it's not the issue. Like, that's why you get like taught. If you ever go to like a seminar or, you know, a class about how to present, yeah. which you often do if you like work in like academia, that they have like really clear like guidelines about how to make a presentation mm-hmm. better, which makes it clear that it's like, it's just the way it's used and not the tool itself.
Totally. Yeah. I think especially to your point, Ella, educators are extremely aware of this. And in 2010, the New York Times Learning blog interviewed assistant professor Monica Poole about how she actually uses PowerPoint with her students. And she said, quote, "Dependence on PowerPoint to the exclusion of other tools and styles and genres is a problem, as is using PowerPoint badly. But that's a problem for any genre of communication, written, oral, or digital. You can create a dreadful eulogy, persuasive essay, lecture, eyewitness report, blog post, or inaugural address. That doesn't mean that these genres of communication are inherently bad. It means that you can do them badly or well. My challenge and my pleasure is teaching my students to do what they need to do and to do it well." And to Caroline's point, I will say one of the greatest things about presentation software, especially now with free versions like Google Slides, is that it is so widely accessible and easy to use.
Yeah.
Berkeley engineering professor Ken Goldberg said, "It's easy to ridicule it for its corporate nature, but the real story is about how participatory and democratic it is. High school kids use it, rabbis use it, people even use it for wedding toasts."
Yeah, uh-huh. And silly little TikToks about their favorite Disney princess, you know?
But there are people who don't just like PowerPoint. They love PowerPoint.
Mm.
And there is perhaps one person who outspokenly...
Someone married PowerPoint, didn't they?
Hitchpot, yeah. There is one person who outspokenly loves PowerPoint, maybe more than anyone else. And Wired Magazine did something really clever, which is that they asked Edward Tufte to write a piece against PowerPoint, and then they had a piece written in favor of PowerPoint.
Oh, fun.
Can you guess who wrote that article?
Is this someone we would know?
I think so. Maybe,
can I have a clue?
Maybe not a first guess. They're an Oscar winner.
What? I feel like that's put me even like more confused than I was 10 seconds ago.
Oscar winner wrote a presentation about that. No, I don't know. Go on.
They're a Grammy winner.
What?
Madonna?
They're a Tony winner.
What?
And they're a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's David Byrne, formerly of the Talking Heads.
Oh my goodness.
Why?
Okay, interesting.
So the article from 2003 is titled "Learning to Love PowerPoint." And in it, he says, "Although I began by making fun of the medium, I soon realized I could actually create things that were beautiful. I could bend the program to my own whim and use it as an artistic agent. The pieces became like short films. Some were sweet, some were scary, and some were misterioso," which is such a David Byrne thing to say, my God. "What's more, the application can be made to run by itself. No one even needs to be at the podium. How fantastic! I truly wish I had David Byrne eyes for everything."
Uh-huh,
everyone needs to find someone who loves you as much as David Byrne loves PowerPoint, apparently. How fantastic. How mysterioso. So 2 years after writing that, he would then go on to give a talk at UC Berkeley titled "I Heart PowerPoint." And he started by saying, "Hello.
This is so weird.
My name is David Byrne, and I'm going to do an introduction to PowerPoint."
Did he do a PowerPoint?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
He showed his multimedia art where he like mixes stock images and his own music. There's one piece, it's just like a forest of those like default arrows of like all colors.
Oh.
And then there's one piece that he describes is so interesting where he uses the like fade transitions and makes them really slow and then puts in this like trance music where it's like very like holy as it like transitions between colors and stuff like that. I think it's just so interesting
and
clever.
In its way, this really connects back to what I was saying at the start, which is, so David Byrne, so this kind of stuff, you could do it with like professional media software, like design software, but David Byrne didn't have that language or that knowledge of how to do that. So he found a way to do this through PowerPoint because it's very accessible in the same way that I, as a scientist, like... scientific images used to be completely drawn out by hand, and then they became
That's
like done through design software. and where I and a lot of my contemporaries have fallen is this: we make them on our own through PowerPoint because it's incredibly easy to use and very intuitive. Basically, what I'm saying is I'm like David Byrne.
Where's my Oscar, Grammy, Tony?
But the point stands, you know?
Yeah, totally. One point that I also love, and maybe you and I wouldn't have this, be willing to be this humble, is he even shouts out Edward Tufte in his PowerPoint. He like shows like a graph of his that he really enjoys, which I thought was nice.
Nah, fuck you, Edward Tufte.
What's so amazing is that during all of this presentation, in the audience for David Byrne's show were the creators of PowerPoint.
Oh!
Including Robert Gaskins, who we mentioned earlier coming up with the name. As David Byrne would later write in his blog, quote, "I was terrified. The guys that originally turned PowerPoint into a program were there. What were they gonna think? Well, couldn't they just get up and talk about their invention?"
You say he was a fanboy for the PowerPoint creators and he was nervous about them seeing his PowerPoint. That's
he's
cute.
Like, he's talking to his Oscar at home being like, "I'm so nervous, what should I do?" But after finishing the presentation, he wrote, quote, "I can relax, they're laughing." He did tell me afterwards that he liked the PowerPoint as theater idea, which was a relief. I mean, there is a lot of hatred for this program out there, and a lot of people laugh at the mere mention of bullet points. So he must have felt kind of vulnerable.
Aww.
You know, tremendously sweet, because he just unironically loves it. But I want to dig into one thing that David Byrne just said there, because in that presentation, he made a prediction from the year 2005 that turned out to be absolutely correct. So what he said in the presentation, as UC Berkeley News Center reported, quote, "Eventually," Byrne said, "PowerPoint could be the foundation for presentational theater, with roots in Brechtian drama and Asian puppet theater. What I'm doing now is not considered theater, but give it a little more time," he said modestly. And he was not wrong. It was around this time that actually TED Talks really began to boom in popularity.
Oh, of course, love a TED Talk.
And to Caroline's point, I'm going to say a hot take that I know will annoy a lot of teens out there, which is that is not a TikTok that uses the green screen background while the person is talking another form of a digital presentation?
Yes.
It is, because that's exact. I use the green screen feature on TikTok all the time.
Yeah.
Especially to show papers, like, 'cause when I like reference a paper, I'll have it behind me.
Yes!
I do that all the time, and I'm like, this, all it feels like is like I'm doing a presentation. Like, that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
And to your point, you know, that's one of the great things about TikTok is the accessibility of it, right? The ease of use to do these things. PowerPoint has been used even outside of TikTok and TED Talks. PowerPoint has been used for comedy a lot. Vulture put out an article in 2018 titled, "Why is PowerPoint having a comedy moment?" In it, they talk about its use by Chrissy Milazzo, Demi Adejuwibe, whose presentations I have actually seen live earlier this year, and it's amazing. The Twitter account SlideShare Gems, that's run by Neil Cicerega, is also hilarious. He just like catalogs horrendously ugly PowerPoint slides.
Nice. Oh, I love that.
Really great. But like, while some of these jokes are definitely like laughing at PowerPoint, some of these are laughing like with and because of PowerPoint. Mm. You guys have already listed so many examples, so I almost don't even have to say this, but Chrissy Milazzo in the article mentions that she's typically a writer by trade and not usually a stand-up. But she was inspired to give this PowerPoint comedy performance because of a PowerPoint that she saw that was going around a few years ago detailing the conspiracy that Jack Antonoff and Lord were dating. I don't know if any of you guys saw that PowerPoint.
No, but I want
to. But, you know, it was a tool that let her step into this world of stand-up comedy at being a writer, right?
The thing about PowerPoint is that in comedy, it is the master of comedic timing.
Yeah. And do you know who else loves PowerPoint comedy?
Who?
Robert Gaskins, yet again.
Of course.
The Vulture article goes, quote, "Robert Gaskins, one of PowerPoint's aforementioned co-creators, says he sees nothing subversive or unusual about PowerPoint's developing comedy market. And after viewing some clips of the above entertainers' sets, he thought they'd all use his product in its natural way. In fact, having studied Shakespeare for over a decade, Gaskins has always regarded his creation as having a certain theatrical bent. The reveal of younger comics utilizing it in this manner seems less of a surprise to him
and more of a vindication that society is overcoming its lingering assumption that PowerPoint is only for stuffy business professionals, and finally seeing his original vision in whole. Focusing PowerPoint's market on business presentations was simply what made the most sense in the software's infancy, because this was the highest value use for the product, and the one most easily understood by customers. How could I have described the Chrissy Milazzo use case in 1984? It would have been impossible. And listeners, if you're still not convinced, and you want to see Robert Gaskin's vision realized, and you're in New York City on October 4th, I will be a part of a PowerPoint comedy show called Next Slide Please at Caveat NYC. It'll also be live streamed if you're not in New York City. But yeah, details will be in the show notes. I'm excited to all I've learned from David Byrne to good use, hopefully.
Yay. Oh, that's going to be so cool.
There's actually one last thing I want to end on, not on self-promotion.
I do self-promotion. If you want to see PowerPoint used in an actually funny way that Tom's not doing.
I choked on the water, sorry.
Check out my TikTok, which I presented to a live audience during a comedy set.
Oh, wow.
If you show up to the Caveat Theater on October 4th, I'll be redoing that set without attribution. No, there is one thing I want to end on that isn't self-promotion, and it's that David Byrne was actually right about two predictions. The first was PowerPoint Theater, but the second was something he said in his Wired article in 2003, which was, quote, "I began to see PowerPoint as a meta program, one that organizes and presents stuff created in other applications." He goes on to talk about, like, integrating music and multimedia into his presentations, and he's right about that. But his insight is actually accidentally much more correct than he could ever know, because in 2017, Tom Wildenhaine writes a paper and a video presentation titled "On the Turing Completeness of Microsoft PowerPoint." Do either of you happen to know what that means?
No.
So we should definitely cover Turing completeness in detail another time. But the long and short of it is, Turing completely has nothing to do with the Turing test. They were just both things discovered by Alan Turing. But it's the idea that a programming language is Turing complete if it can be used to replicate any other computer program. So, for example, any program written in C can be theoretically rewritten in Python.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may be slower or less optimal or harder to read, but because they're both Turing complete, anything one of them can do, the other can do in theory.
Yeah.
And Wildenhaine's argument is that by using a combination of animations and auto shapes in PowerPoint, you can use PowerPoint as a programming language to make any computer program, theoretically?
Yeah, I guess so.
It would be horrendously slow, and this is obviously meant as a joke, but he then goes on to show a basic computer program that he wrote in PowerPoint that can recognize if a number it's given is a palindrome. I can send you guys a picture of it in action. It looks ridiculous. The video will be in the show notes. I can't recommend it enough. It is like peak computer humor.
Oh, so I see that he's using like the animation buttons to read the code that he's written.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a basic machine devised using these like primitive functions in PowerPoint.
That's so dumb.
Oh my god.
It is, like, but that's what I love about it.
I love it, but also, like, do people need some hobbies? I guess
this is the hobby, isn't it? And we will not shame anyone's PowerPoint based hobbies.
No, absolutely not.
This is one of my favorite videos, just because if you watch the video, it's such a descent into chaos. Like, he says this ridiculous claim, and then you slowly realize, like, oh, he's serious. Oh, he's done.
Oh, he did it. Oh, no.
He goes on to say in his paper that there are advantages to PowerPoint over conventional programming languages, including, quote, "Its ability to be programmed entirely visually rather than confusing text-based languages would make it easier for novice programmers to learn." Obviously not true. a joke.
No.
And then he ends the paper by saying, "With enough advances in this area, it is increasingly likely that every application will one day be run within Microsoft PowerPoint."
Wow. That's a bold claim to make, but I love it.
Unfortunately, Robert Gaskins didn't have a quote about this presentation. I don't know if this was part of his vision, but it is pinned on his website, so he's clearly happy with it.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. He's clearly seen it and is like, this is good.
This is good. So, like, as silly as that is, and it's definitely silly, what makes me so happy about that paper and that presentation isn't the endless capability of PowerPoint as a programming language, but the endless capacity for creativity for even something as plain as PowerPoint, right? The fact that PowerPoint can inspire Edward Tufte's anger and like a teacher's careful consideration and David Byrne's deep love and the comedian's performance and the programmer's like endless tinkering says so much about both the software, but also our capacity to find beautiful things in the wildest places. And when the creators of PowerPoint themselves so openly love all of this chaotic creativity, it's very hard not to love PowerPoint also.
I'm happy to hop onto the PowerPoint loving bandwagon. I was very PowerPoint neutral before. Yeah,
I was already there. I love PowerPoint.
You loved
I'm
it.
So
this is just reconfirming all of my love.
It's just a victory lap.
Now I have evidence to back it up, you know? Thank you, Tom. Who knew that PowerPoint could be so exciting? I knew.
That was the thing for me, was just like, I didn't realize that PowerPoint could like generate such strong feelings in any direction. Yeah.
And that's exactly what makes it. That's exactly why I love it.
What's that coming over the hill? It's Review Corner. It's Review Corner.
It's Review Corner.
Tom.
Yeah?
It's Review Corner.
It sure is. You gave me the gesture like, come on, give me the review.
Come on.
Let's go. Chop, chop. We don't have time to sing songs here. Let's go. This review comes to us from KDGRRRRRR. And they say, great blend of science and fun. I am someone who values lifelong learning, and it is so nice to find a cheery, well-formulated podcast with hosts that also have that passion. What a wonderful addition to the Maximum Fun Network.
Aww, thank you so much.
Thank you, KDGRRRRRR.
Well, I definitely also want to give a shout out to all the Max Fun listeners have all been very welcoming and kind.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's very appreciated.
You've been so kind. It has been so wonderful.
Incredibly,
to see.
Incredibly
so
sweet.
Yeah.
Do we have any plugs to plug?
I got a plug.
If it's your show link, again, you can't do it because you've done it once already.
Too bad. this will be in the show notes, but on October 4th in New York City, I'll be at Next Slide, Please. Doing some PowerPoint comedy at the Caveat Theater. Or you can buy tickets for the live stream and VOD.
Oh, nice.
Amazing.
Caroline?
I'm going to plug our socials. You should follow us on all of our socials. We are particularly active on Twitter right now. Ella, what's our Twitter handle?
L-L-E podcast.
Also, we have a Discord server. You can find the link to that at letsleareverythingpod.com.
I'm going to plug, first of all three of us, as individuals, Tom Lum Person, Caroline the Bug, Ella Hubber /Dr. Big Science Energy. Find us on the platforms, you'll see. And this is a really kind of weird one. This is for my job as a public engagement officer for King's College London. I'm holding a photography exhibition for women in science in my department. If you live in or around London, 25th of October, we're doing the photography exhibition. Find details on Eventbrite.
That'll be in the show notes for sure.
This week, we learned about the strange but important ways people carry out scientific experiments on themselves. We learned that our understanding of archaeology is flawed, but we are learning more all the time. And we learned that PowerPoint is the supreme and one and only presentation tool. Join us next time where we will learn about everything.
Oh my god, okay.
Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted and produced by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper, with editing by Ella Hubber and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
But this name clearly worked because, I'm not going to say that again without a voice crack. Shut up. Listen, puberty's hard. It's really hard.
I never heard your voice break so badly before. That was so good.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Let's Learn Everything.
Oh, that gave me some kind of euphoria.
It's called Schadenfreude.
Oh, sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
Oh, boy. No, it's great. It's great. It's always good to have to know what the outro is going to be.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.